on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
I would rather have fewer right readers than more readers, but they're the wrong readers, right? Because that will definitely tank your book and Amazon's algorithms as well, and also bots, all those sort of things. So you really, like you said, alignment.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to The Self-Publishing Show. My name is James Blatch.
And my name is Michael Caine.
My name is Michael Caine. Remember that old song. Welcome, Mark. We're recording this in the UK the day after we have lost our monarch. So it's been quite a strange few hours, hasn't it? It's been a... We knew it was coming. She was 96 years old. But I think, I honestly think the rest of the world also understand the impact and place she's had in our... I mean, I don't say part of the furniture, but she's part of the landscape in which we've grown up and our parents have grown up. It's incredible. End of an era.
Yeah, well, it has. I'm surprising how unsettled it's made me feel. And I think that's not unusual. It is because you know, I'm 48 now, and you're a little older than me. But we haven't known any other monarch, which is odd. And then you kind of start thinking exactly how interwoven she is, not just in things like memories. I mean, I remember her coming to Lowestoft. I remember standing on the street with my brother and my mum as her and Prince Philip went past waving at everybody. That was in 85, so I was 12. And I remember that quite well. And then so that's the kind of personal interweaving. But then you think about the societal interweaving. So apart from things like banknotes, coins, passports, the anthems, now it's got to say the king, not queen.
Yeah.
The fact that we are saying the king, that hasn't been said since 1952.
Some say it sounds Shakespearean when you say
it does. I used to be a lawyer, as you know, and the Bar Council last night sent out a memo reminding everyone, reminding silks, so senior barristers, they're not QCs anymore, they're now KCs.
Oh,
the King's Council.
King's Council.
So it'll be small things like that we haven't even thought of yet. Will be. You know, we'll change, and you wanted to record this at midday, and I it's when I said we would, but then I thought, well, there's a church over there. I think at midday the bells are going to be ringing.
Yes, muffled bell. We're having that as well.
So yeah, I thought let's do this a little earlier. But it is, it's a funny one. I mean, it's, you know, I saw the bookseller. I mean, in terms of, you know, relevance to writing and writers, the bookseller put out a statement, fairly bland statement today about, you know, the same way as we're seeing everywhere else about thoughts and prayers and all that stuff. But it is, it's weird.
Well, I was going to say, for historical fiction writers, I can think of quite a few who write kings and queens, either fantasy-based or UK-based. And they always set them in medieval times and there's upheaval. And it's interesting to see, if you think about Diana, the Queen, the various things that happened, that sort of upheaval, that impact on people, that tittle-tattle, if you want to call it, the substance of stories is alive and well in the 21st century. And this death of a monarch is, you know,
It is, but then there's I mean, she was on the throne for 70 years, right? So you look in George Martin's world, Game of Thrones, they typically didn't last that long. Obviously, he's basing that off medieval history and English medieval history, which is, that's interesting. But then, as we also said, before we started recording, we're flying to America next week, less than 2 weeks. And I think it's very likely that the funeral will be whilst we're in the air on Monday, the 19th?
19th, yeah.
And it just reminded me when Princess Diana died in 92? I can't remember. Anyway, whatever it was, whenever she died, it must be 92. I was in Vegas. I was in San Francisco when she died, and then at her funeral, I was in Las Vegas, and it was one of the weirdest things for an English person like me to be on the strip in my hotel room watching this kind of huge kind of national moment, national outpouring of grief with people wailing and throwing bouquets in front of the cortege as it went past, whilst I was, you know, in Vegas with the sound of slot machines in the background and neon on the strip. It was a really weird experience. And I think probably we're going to get something quite similar to that again, which is,
yes.
So basically the takeaway from that is that the Royal Household should consult with me for my travel plans, because
I don't understand why they don't. I don't understand why we're not part of Operation London Bridge.
I'm not talking about the actual funerals. I think basically when I travel or when I'm nearly about to travel, it's dangerous for royals.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, I was in France. I was nowhere near Paris when Diana was killed. And
they're still looking for that car.
Equally weird. That for Uno. Yes. I should also say, for romance authors, I think Philip and Elizabeth's romance it's had its trials and tribulations in the middle part. We don't know how much of The Crown, if you've watched that, is true, but it's certainly based on something. I know that. I know long time ago, long before Netflix, I was told that there were some cabinet minutes from that period concerned about Philip that would never be released because the government have the right under the 30-year rule not to release some of it. So, that's a relationship. That's a real life relationship. And in terms of a romance, I think a very beautiful one that lasted and in the end settled into an enduring, incredible image, those elderly couple. And so sad when he died. And that picture, heartbreaking picture of the Queen sitting by herself at his funeral in the middle of COVID with a mask on.
Yeah.
Anyway, if this is not floating your boat, so we'll move on to more apposite things. So yeah, we're recording this on Friday. Oh my goodness, terrifying.
Scout's got
a swan.
He hasn't got a swan.
On September the 9th, September the 9th, it's going out on the weekend, the following week, Monday, as you say, we're going out to Florida. I imagine we think the Queen's funeral might well be on that Monday the 19th. We're not sure. You'll know by the time this goes out when it is. However, if you want to come and say hello to us and pass on your condolences in person, we're going to be in Nink at the Shark Tooth Tavern the following Friday. So that is the 23rd. We'll be there. We'll be around Nink all week, of course, if you're at the conference. But if you're not at the conference in particular and you want to come down and just have a drink with us, the Shark Tooth Tavern and the Tradewinds Resort, which is on the Gulf Boulevard Road, on the 23rd of September, we'll be there from 9-ish. I think I'm moderating a session earlier, but there's some sort of clash, so we're doing it a little bit later. I suspect we'll be there earlier. Okay, a few things to do. Mark, before we get going, let us talk about our Patreon supporters. So we are about to select a BookBub victim. That's taken BookBub, isn't it? We can't use that one.
BookLab.
Book Lab victim. So if you haven't listened to these episodes, they're brilliant. Some of the best episodes I think we do, where we take a book, self-published book, and we analyze it and we critically feedback the cover, the blurb, and the writing. And we're looking forward to doing that again. And we need a victim. So you've got to be a gold level subscriber, Patreon, which is, I think, $3 for an episode. So it's dirt cheap. And you get all sorts of goodies. You get an opportunity to win a big course. You also get some other goodies sent to you when you sign up. But if you go to patreon.com/self-publishing show, if you sign up in the next week or so, we're going to be selecting probably in 2 weeks from now. So you've got a couple of weeks to sign up and let it be known that you are willing to have your book fed back on. We have a blog out today, How to Generate and Test Story Ideas. Thank you, Dan, for that blog. You'll find that at selfpublishingformula.com. Which brings us, Mark, onto our feature interview, which is with Olivia Hale, who is the author of a romance series, in particular, specifically, Billionaire Romance Series. And you're going to hear all about how she has become niched down with billionaire romance and how she approaches her writing. She's been fabulously successful, 7-figure author. It's a very interesting interview. Brilliant author, brilliant business person. Let's hear from Olivia, then Mark and I will be back for a quick chat.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Olivia Hale, welcome to The Self-Publishing Show. We're going to be talking about getting going, I think, in a sector, doing some research finding the niche, making it work, and some of the tips, because you've gone from a standing start not that long ago to some pretty successful figures. So why don't you introduce yourself to us?
Yes. Hi, super fun to be here. I'm a huge podcast listener of this podcast specifically, others as well. But so my name is Olivia. I started 3.5 years ago now. And like you said, a standing start. I knew absolutely nothing about self-publishing, but I threw myself into the industry. I thought it was just so much fun to learn, and there were so many resources out there, right? And since then, I've started writing contemporary romance, and I have 15 books out now, writing my 16th at the moment.
Wow.
And it's just been a wild journey, to be honest. Each year has been better than the last, and yeah, I wouldn't change it for the world.
So from a standing start, before we get into the detail, can you give me an idea of the kind of the level of success you're having in whatever metric you're comfortable with letting us know?
For sure, for sure. So my last year, my third year doing this, was a 7-figure year, which was astonishing. It was much higher than I mean, obviously I was aiming high, but that was exceeded my expectations for sure. And the year before that was a 6-figure year.
Wow.
So both my second and third years have been very good, to say the least.
Yeah. But I know it wasn't always smooth. And I know at the beginning you had some misfires as well as hits. So obviously you're somebody who adapts and learns, such a key thing in any business, frankly, but particularly self-publishing. So let's get into the detail. Can I ask you about writing, first of all, because that's quite a production in 3 years. Did you say 15 books?
Yes, and 3.5, right? Yeah, it's been a lot of books, I would say. I think I got up to 6 books last year, which was a lot for me. I know some authors can do a book a month. That's not me. So I'm slowing down production now for sure. But yeah, when I discovered self-publishing, I can say that was in December of 2018, I think. I was searching the web, probably up to no good, and I found this blog post it had a very clickbaity title, right? It was... author plans to retire from corporate job by writing romance, which was very intriguing. You know, I was a student at the time doing my master's, and I didn't have an income. And I thought, this is interesting. I've always wanted to be a writer, you know? And so I fell through the self-publishing rabbit hole, right? Like Alice, essentially. And the next 2 months, I devoured everything I could online. And when you are a student, you do have a fair amount of free time. So I was reading a lot about this. And 2 months later, I sat down and started writing my first contemporary romance. And I'd been a writer before then, but dabbling in sort of, you know, stories and fantasy and literary fiction. And I had this, you know, massive plan that in 20 years after I'd worked in a normal career, you know, quote unquote, I would settle down, I would become an author, I would try to publish traditionally, and hopefully I would have some lived experiences by then, you know? And this really, well, I'm ahead of schedule, just say that, although it's not traditionally published. And so I'd always wanted to do that. But again, I was planning for the future. And when I found self-publishing, it was like, it completely opened my eyes. I was like, oh, I can do everything myself. I can be my own boss. I don't have to wait for, you know, a trad agency to find me. And I could write genre fiction. And that was actually very liberating creatively for me. Because I think when you're trying to write literary fiction or something else for a traditional publisher, it's easy, I think, to have the impression that you have to write the most original thing ever, right? It has to be incredible to get their attention. It needs to break all kinds of genres, and you know, you want to win the Nobel Prize for it or whatever. And that's a complete blank page, and that's terrifying, right? And so genre fiction was very liberating creatively for me. The fact that you had structures, a bit of a formula to follow, genre conventions, right? All of that. And so I wrote my first book in 6 weeks, which was probably, I've never done anything since then or before then, really, I think.
Wow. You did a first draft in 6 weeks.
Yes. But that was probably also what I published.
Okay.
I made every mistake in the book that first year, especially that first book. So I published it, not having edited it. It had a homemade cover, which I'm actually not all that against, because I do still do some of my own covers. If you train yourself and you like doing it and it works out for you, that's fine, I think. But that cover was not to market. I gave it the vaguest title possible. And vagueness is not your friend in genre fiction. You need to be specific, right? What do readers want? And give it a title that means they can identify, you know, very quickly. Like both your books, James, right, have flight in the title and an airplane on them. So it's brilliant, right?
And a subtitle that says a Cold War thriller.
Yes, exactly. So they, you know, in 0.2 seconds, they know what they're getting, right? Mine was not that at all. So the first month, my first book made $48. A whopping, almost $50. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I retired on the spot.
Yeah.
And so that was an abject failure. But I was so, you know, energized by the whole process that I sat down and wrote my second book immediately. And that did much better. So I think my second book really kept me afloat for an entire year after that. So right off the gate, it started making me $2,000 to $3,000 a month.
Wow.
And that was purely based on much better passive marketing. So I had a much better title, much better cover. And then something happened with the Amazon algorithms, right? That luck, I guess. I mean, it just took off in a moderately successful way, I would guess.
Yeah.
But for me, it was huge at the time, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, that's very successful, I think, with one or two books. So your niche that you chose, the subgenre that you chose, and by the way, I think that's a really interesting observation that realizing you can write in genre fiction is liberating. Because I think I went through that as well. I think probably it's the cliche that most people, when they think I want to be a writer, they think of that big literary fiction book that, that as you say, challenges all sorts of expectations. And as soon as you realize...
Most people's minds.
As soon as you realize you can write a James Bond book, and that's more fun, or in my case, you know, a thriller or a romance, suddenly it all becomes accessible, I think. Whereas as that big literary fiction for 99,000 out of 100,000 is not accessible. It's not going to happen.
No.
So yeah, it's a liberating moment.
And it allows you to do what you actually think is fun, right? Which is creating characters, putting one word after the other. So you really get to get down into the nitty gritty fast, I think, if you write genre fiction.
Yeah. So romance obviously caught your eye. Were you a romance reader?
I was, yes. I mean, I read very widely in different genres. I still do. But my favorite subplots were always the romantic ones. You know, even in like the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, I love Aragorn and Arwen, you know. And so I'd always been drawn to that. And I think had a pretty good understanding of what makes romance work, you know, in books. And so I think I was never really even, I never really even considered another genre. It was always going to be romance, I think, for me. But I stumbled into contemporary romance. I don't really know why I made that decision, but I did at the time. And in the beginning, that was my only niche, was contemporary romance, which is not a niche at all. It's a huge genre, right?
Yeah.
And that was part of my mistake that first year, was that I didn't have the subtitle, a Cold War thriller, right?
Yeah.
Which I should have, I mean, not that subtitle, but
no.
I should have been
no.
Much more specific than I was.
A small town romance or something like that, that just
exactly.
says in a tagline what this book is. So tell me about the book. What did you, was it small town? Was it city? What were the sort of tropes you went for?
So my first two books were office romances set in a big city. They were essentially billionaire, but I didn't market them as such. I didn't really know that term at the time.
Okay.
And that's why my second book did so well. I had accidentally tapped into a niche, right? And I titled it Arrogant Boss, which is not the least bit clever. But it is very clear.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the point. It also has a keyword in the title, People Search for Boss. So I think that's why it did so well without, I mean, I had zero name recognition. I did no active marketing. I didn't have a newsletter. You know, I'm still not editing my books, right?
Right.
But just that, you know, the keyword in the title and the very clear packaging meant it did pretty well. Did I learn from this though? No, I did not, unfortunately.
So you're making $2,000 to $3,000 a month with book two. Mm-hmm. Was there any read through to book one? Did that start picking up at this stage?
A little bit as well, yes.
Okay.
But that book was still packaged a little incorrectly, you know, and there was a bit, but not a ton, no. The engine was book two, really.
Yeah, and what was your next step then?
So I learned absolutely nothing and wrote two small town romances.
Okay.
I incorrectly assumed I was now the type of author who had a readership, I suppose, and I could switch between, you know, little subgenres or sub niches, and readers would follow me. And I kept giving them vague titles, which I liked better than Arrogant Boss, which is very on the nose. And they didn't sell at all. right? That entire first year, I released 4 books, and all my money, which was 5 figures, was made from essentially 1 book, the second book.
Right. So the Sawtown ones didn't really take off.
No. And I just kept publishing them. I mean, two of them. Yeah. It takes you a long time, I think, in this industry to really get it.
Yeah.
You know?
So at that point, having learned this, maybe now is the time where you think, okay, let's do more of what's working.
Exactly. And that was my year two when that started.
Okay.
And that was coincided with the pandemic. So I had a lot of time on my hands. I finished my master's and I decided to try this full time for another year. Because I did still make $2,000 or $3,000 from that book, you know, every month. So I had a small platform, I suppose, or safety net. And that summer I found the SPF podcast. And I started listening to through all your backlist, which is maybe not what you call a podcast, but all the previous episodes, right, that summer. And I remember Mark or you saying that you needed to treat this as a business, right? I was not doing that at all. I was writing at odd hours. I wasn't logging my expenses. And so that summer, I really, really nailed down like what works for me and what do I need to do going forward. And that's really when I created the inkling of a brand, right? So I niched down in billionaire. And office romances, what had worked with the book that I made money on before, right?
Yeah.
And try to replicate that. I finally got a newsletter, which took me like over a year to start. I started actually retaining readers, right? Because you really only want to have to grab a reader once, right? Then the reader should hopefully be yours. And so I started implementing all of those changes and I wrote my first big series, which was a billionaire series that had the same on the nose titles as book number two. They're called $1 Billion Enemy, $1 Billion Fiance. So readers can tell immediately this is a billionaire romance and it's going to involve an enemies to lovers story, right? And the book packaging was much tighter, better titles, better covers, better blurbs, all of that. And I was still not doing any marketing in terms of ads. I was doing newsletter promos though. So every release, I tried to get it higher and higher on the charts on Amazon by stacking promos for launch week, the newsletter promotions, right?
Yep.
And then I was counting on the fact that if I get more visibility in the store, the books will start selling organically, I hoped, right? Because I hoped I'd done enough work on the packaging to make them actually sell organically. And they did. So that year was a great year for me. And it taught me a lot. And those books really built the foundation for my brand.
So a lot of passive advertising here, but you're not running paid ads at this stage?
So I dabbled a little bit in Amazon ads at the time and also BookBub ads, I will say, which I've never found to be particularly successful for me. But I would say, well, dabble really is the right word there. I wasn't spending a lot and I would usually shut them off after a few weeks because I felt like this wasn't really doing anything. I'm not a big numbers benchmarking person, although I've taken your courses and they're great, right? And I know those are the steps you should take, but I just wasn't doing it in terms of the Excel sheets, the benchmarking, that sort of thing. And I also found that, to be frank, it didn't really feel like I needed them because things were picking up organically. And so I felt like my time was better spent writing the next book. Or improving the newsletter, you know?
Yeah. You're not tempted to go back and rewrite book one?
I have thought about it. I have gone back and re-edited the first 3 books. Not me. I mean, my editor has done that. I've switched out their covers, all of that. The first book is a bit short and I hint at a lot of subplots that I never develop.
Okay.
So I have thought about doing that. But at the same time, you know, the opportunity cost between writing a new book and it's a tough thing because I am a big believer in you have to keep your backlist up to date.
Yeah.
I think that's the main engine in your income, or hopefully it should be, right? It's passive income because you've already written the books.
Yeah.
Money. I'm a big believer in that. But yeah, exactly. And I think it's also, last point, that first book, I feel like this is important to say, actually, because I was so dejected that first month when it made $48, right? But over 3.5 years, that book has made just over 6 figures.
Wow.
So that's purely from the power of read-through, right?
Yeah.
So no book you write is ever a lost cause completely, I would say.
Yeah. In terms of the writing experience then, so, I mean, these subgenres, one thing I've learned doing this show is that they the reader expectation is off the charts compared to where it used to be. I just don't believe in the 1970s and 60s readers had conversations with each other like they do today about enemies to lovers and friends to lovers and all the various tropes and things that they expect to find in these books. And they're quite hard.
Granular.
Yeah. I mean, they know what makes up the type of book they like to read, and you've basically hit those beats. So how did you learn all of that, and how do you plot out your books now to make sure you're meeting that?
It's a great question. I've done a lot of thinking about that probably the past year and a half. You know, what do readers like about my books in particular, right? What's my brand? What do readers expect of the genre? Yes, but also me, right? And so that means going through reviews, unfortunately, and also listening to when they email you and what things do they consistently mention, right? So for me, those were a couple of things that make up my brand. And so I guess I've distilled that into my books have to include, you know, X, Y, and Z, because that's what readers say they expect from me, right? And then combine that with what's popular in the genre at the time, which means looking at top 100 of the genre, reading, you know, books by fellow authors that do well, and also seeing, I guess, what trends are popular. So I think Single Dad is pretty popular right now. Seems like there are more books than usual. I think Kalytics also mentioned that recently. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Sorry.
No, it's okay. Alex will charge you now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I work on commission.
Yeah.
You know, by Kalytics now. So, I mean, I think it's a combination of all those things, just being, you know, listening to other things going on in the genre and also listening to your readers, because they will tell you what they like and they don't like. They're usually pretty vocal about that. Just make sure you listen, I think.
So you settled on billionaire romance and mm-hmm. enemies to lovers. So I'm guessing is the billionaire the guy normally and the...
Yes.
It can be the way around. So and the woman is the unimpressed with his arrogant swagger, but annoyingly really fancies him. That's kind of how it starts.
Yes. I will say not every book is enemies to lovers. That's a trope I've used a couple of times for sure. And what I do like about billionaire is it's a pretty flexible genre. So the man needs to be rich, to speak frankly, but that's really it. He usually also needs to be in a suit or to have that kind of suaveness to him, right?
Yeah.
But other than that, you can really mold it however you'd like. And I found that to be, again, creatively liberating, you know?
Mm. And do you plot?
I do plot, yes. I did in the beginning, which was a disaster when, you know, became time to edit, and I hate editing. It's really my worst, like, I really don't like it. I like writing new stories, you know? And so the more I plot, the less I have to edit. So my first drafts now are pretty clean and they're pretty close to the finished product. So I would say I plot quite extensively in the beginning. I think I probably plot the first 30%, 35% very diligently. And that's often also the most important part of a book in KU, because that's what the first 10% of the look inside, right? So you need to get a good hook in there, a good premise, something you can build a great blurb around. So for in romance, that would be a great meet cute, right? Something explosive happening in those first two or three chapters. So I do plot that pretty extensively. And then I tend to plot the major points of the novel after that. And then I'll write, and then I'll go back and sort of replot. Okay, what's gonna happen the next two, three chapters? And then I write those, and then things might have fluctuated a little bit. So then I'll plot the next three, four ones.
Okay.
But I always know where I'm heading.
Plotting right? As you go along. And do you use any plotting software? Or do you just use like a Word document to write it out?
I use Plotter.
Okay. Yeah. Plotter. Plotter.
Yeah.
Plotter.
It's an interesting name. Yes.
It's a great name.
But I mean, I really only use Plotter for the first 30-40% of the novel.
Okay.
And then I get too impatient. I need to start writing.
Yeah. So in an ideal world, an author like you would do your first draft and then hand it off to someone else who tidies it up and publishes it. You never want to see it again. Do you want to the next? You've moved on in your mind to the next book.
Yes. And that's always a problem when I'm writing the last two or three chapters. When I have to write the epilogue of a book, right? My head is already like far down the next book and much more excited about that book, right? So... yeah, I hate writing epilogues as well. Or it's fun to write, but I never want to be there.
I actually quite like the editing bit, but I think that's unusual. Most of my friends seem to not like it. The epilogue, is this something that you use as a mailing list
Yes. So there's an epilogue that's part of the book and that has to stay with the book, right? That's a big reader expectation in romance. But then I do write and plot little bonus stories, and they can be between 5,000 and 10,000 words. And they are like a bonus epilogue that I give out for newsletter subscribers. Mm. And so I have that for all of my series. Yes. And all upcoming books will have that. Because again, now my readers have come to expect that as well, right?
Yeah.
My newsletter has become a great resource, and I really love that. But yeah, it's a bit of work as well.
I'm just making a note because I should write a bonus epilogue for my second book to link it to the first mm-hmm. book and give it away as a mailing list. In fact, an ideal thing would be the two, as you say, the epilogue that goes with the book. That will be the link to the first book and the bonus epilogue to get people on the mailing list. There's no reason why this doesn't work in thriller as well as romance. I know, you know, I interviewed Lucy Score recently, and she's, you know, her mailing list grows very well using bonus epilogue. So
yeah, I mean, my mailing list has exclusively grown from that, you know, and I really buckled down and did that beginning of last year, I think. And now it's at 30,000 people,
okay.
Which I know is small compared to Lucy's course, but I'm very, very pleased with that. You know,
it's bigger than mine. It's very good. So you've really grown through readers driving sales, which is like the best way of doing it, because it's a very high margin for a start. There's not like a 30-40% spend on ads there. But you do attribute this to all the passive bits, all the packaging of the book, which is something we talk about more and more. It's the Susie K. Quinn kind of mantra, is your package is absolutely everything. And in a conversation I did a live a couple of nights ago with Craig Martell into the 20 Books group, and we talked about alignment, just that real laser focus on everything being aligned. So your blurb, mm-hmm. your title, obviously your look inside and your content, all meeting reader expectation, and the cover obviously mm-hmm. as well. So I think this is where your golden juice is, if you like. That's what you've got right.
Yeah, and I agree with all of that, you know, and I'm a big proponent of that. When I speak to other authors, I always talk about that as well. Because I think, you know, readers are really sophisticated when they're looking for a new book. There are so many books on Amazon for them to sort through, or Barnes & Noble's, or, you know, whatever store you're on, right? And so they need to be able to identify within, like, it's not even a second, it's 0.2 maybe, if this is a book they might enjoy. And they know very well what books they'll like and they won't like, right? So you just need to make sure you meet that. And you can't give them a reason to click away.
Yeah.
You know, so everything on your book page needs to be impeccable.
Yes.
And, you know, you can't, let's say you're writing paranormal, you can't have them read the entire blurb and then find out in the last sentence that this book has vampires in it. That needs to be front and
you
know, top, like first line, communicating on the cover, all of that.
Yeah. So in some ways, it's more important, your marketing bits, your blurb and cover and so on. It's more important that they tell the reader what the book is than tell the reader it's a good book and they should read it, which is kind of what you think the blurb's about. It's, God, this book, this is why this book's so good. Actually, the most important thing you're doing is letting that mm-hmm. reader know this is the type of book they want to read. And the price to pay for getting that wrong is bad reviews. Not necessarily because people think the book's bad, but because they were the wrong reader.
Exactly. And, you know, I would rather have fewer right readers than more readers, but they're the wrong readers, right? Because that will definitely tank your book and Amazon's algorithms as well, and also bots, all those sort of things. So you really, like you said, alignment, right?
Yeah.
Making sure everything is in. And that's true with your author brand as well. You need to make sure that every book you release is building on the previous books and building on your brand, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if I were to release a small town novel tomorrow, some readers would follow me along, but a lot of them wouldn't, right? And I wouldn't fault them for that, because they've come to expect something from me. And there's a level of trust in that, right?
Yeah.
Because I really believe that when readers buy our books, they're buying them for $3.99 or $4.99, but what they're really buying them with is time, right?
Yeah.
It might take 6 hours to read a novel, might take 12, might take 24 if you're reading George R. R. Martin, right? But those are hours of their life they're never getting back. And if you don't make those hours worth it for this person, for the reader, they're not going to come back. You know, I know I won't when I'm a reader.
Yeah.
So you just need to really, you know, honor that trust and make sure you deliver what you promised them.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And one more illustration, I think, from my side of things, is that I did did change slightly from my first book. The second, first book is a little bit literary, I have to say. It's like the book from within me, and it's thematic. And the second book, I approached the second book to be James Patterson, Clive Cussler, kind of genre, because I think that's the long term for me. I can't write a roller coasting from the heart about my dad and everything in every book. So it's got to be
every 6 months.
It's got to be genre fiction fitting into that. And I did worry. I worried that I would upset some readers from the first book who really loved the first book. And that happened, and I could see it. It was just the odd review, and it said the things I thought that they would say. I watched my rating go down. I think it bottomed out about 4.4. But I was then heavily advertising into Clive Cussler, using Clive Cussler as a keyword, because he's a good comp author for me for this genre. And it started to move back up. So it's not that my book was poor enough to get lower rating. It's finding the right readers for it. And once I found Clive Cussler's tribe, it matched their expectations, and that's where bad reviews and good reviews come from, I think, primarily. I mean, obviously, if you'd written a terrible book, you're going to get bad reviews, but, you know, that's subjective.
But then also, you made a strategic decision, right, to switch slightly in tone in the book, right?
Yeah.
And as long as you know why you did that and you had a strategy behind that, I think that's, you know, perfectly valid, right?
Yeah.
And then you found the newer and, let's say, better, obviously no reader is better than the other, but the better for you readers.
The better matched. Readers for
Exactly.
And a lot of the old readers have come with me, and so that's a real good illustration of exactly what we're talking about. So so you stuck with Billionaire?
I am stuck with it now that I've built my brand on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I stuck with that, and I wrote my second big series, which I used everything I learned from the first and pumped that into the second. That's done extremely well, just say that. That was the series that really launched me into incredible months. And that was the series that landed me in the top 100 for the first time on those launches.
And that's so in the .com site.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And all genres. Yeah. That was a lot of fun. And I started advertising in January of this year properly, right? So actually using Facebook ads, Amazon ads with a much higher ad spend. It was my first time using Facebook ads, for example. And I felt like that's also been a big component to keeping my backlist income high, right? Because I'll use my new launches and my newer books to drive sales from my old books, which I really try to make sure to keep updated. Because like I said, I think, you know, once you've written a book, you've written a book. It's passive income for the rest of your life. So make the best use of it you can, you know?
When you say updated, what sort of changes do you make?
Covers. For sure. I'm in the process of doing that again now. I'm also making new paperback covers in Discreet, which is becoming a big thing in romance.
Discreet?
Yes. So that means a paperback cover that doesn't have a man on it.
Okay.
We're hiding the men.
I have to make notes for all these things I learn.
Yeah. So it's essentially it's a paperback cover that you would feel comfortable sitting on a bus with.
Okay.
So they're usually quite, you know, pretty graphics, that sort of thing, but okay. No model.
So Things We Never Got Over, which is Lucy's book. And I think Colleen Hoover's books maybe even today have that kind of look. Yeah, okay.
100%. And they are popular on TikTok as well because people feel comfortable sitting, you know, creating like a little video, you know, with their face next to a book, holding it up.
Yeah,
so that's something I'm doing for older books as well.
What's going to happen to all those male models with those ripped... biceps.
I think they're still going to be there because, you know, in terms of the ebook market, that's not changing a ton on Amazon. So you'll have one ebook with a model and then you'll have a paperback that's more discreet, I think. But the market changes all the time, which is one of the fun things about this job, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've heard the word bandied around discreet, and I've probably asked what it means in the past, but now it's locked in there. Now I know. So we don't have this sort of thing in thriller. Discreet doesn't mean there's no Avro Vulcan on the front cover.
It's just you should hide the planes. Yeah,
hide the planes. We don't need to hide the planes.
No.
Good. Well, this is an amazing story, really, and I'm pleased to hear there's some paid ads going on because it's such an important part for me, and I know most other authors. That's how we kind of drive our sales. So you are running paid ads. Did you say you were targeting them at your backlist primarily, or?
No, I'm targeting them to new readers.
Oh, they are the new readers. Okay.
Yeah, and they're my newer books, but I hopefully they're helping funnel right, readers into my backlist. So new readers will find me. If they like what I write, then they have a lot of books that are very similar, right? Because I've tried to keep my backlist consistent in terms of tone, story, plot, that sort of thing. I mean, not plot, obviously, that would be awful. Yes. It's the exact same plot. But overall, pretty similar. And so a reader who finds me and likes me could go back and read 10 books. So that's quite a valuable reader.
Yes.
For me, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got how many books in the billionaire subgenre? That's probably 12 or 13 of those, is it?
Yes. Yeah. So I have 15 books out. There's one series of four that are not traditional billionaire, but they do sort of work a little bit in the same universe. So I've tried to finagle them to still work, but they're not traditional billionaire. No. So I would say 12 of those are billionaire. Yeah.
And how hard is it to, when you've got those, one of the things that those romance subgenre tropes do is they could be quite constraining, because if you've done 12 books of rich guy in a suit and the slightly reluctant heroine, how many different ways can you work that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm plotting my next big series now. So I have thought that myself, I have to say. But there is still quite a lot of wiggle room within it. Tropes can be turned on their head a little bit, as long as you keep what readers truly like about them. You can always do tropes again, but with different characters, which will have a different feel. I'd like to write really ambitious heroines. That's a part of my brand a little bit. So they often have careers of their own. And that makes for quite fun books to write, because that means that there are, two people who are more on equal footing, being matched and having conflicts with one another. There are still stories left to discover, I think. I'm not sure how many more. I do feel like I have 5 or 6 more billionaire books in me. We'll see after that. Maybe I'll switch to another genre.
Yeah.
Who knows?
At some point, I'm sure you can. I know I know you're slightly trepidatious at doing that because you built such an amazing platform. But I'm sure at some point you can, maybe even a different pen name. Who knows?
I am planning to release a romantic comedy next year.
Okay.
And releasing it wide, which is an experiment for me. So it will be very similar in tone to my billionaire books, which do have a slight romantic comedy vibe to them. But it will be marketed as romantic comedy. And I also want to try wide. That's my first step out of, looking if I could switch this branding slightly, or maybe have like a sub-brand within the Olivia Hale umbrella.
Yes. And I was just looking at your book, so I can see exactly what we were talking about earlier. It does what it says on the tin. Think Outside the Boss, New York Billionaires, Book One. I mean, this is for people who rip through those series from all authors. And Charlotte Bird comes to mind, another billionaire romance author we've had on the podcast in the past. They will read all of hers and all of yours because you've told them in 0.2 seconds that this is the sort of book they read.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
the demand is there, right?
Yeah.
If you can find a way to...
Insatiable demand. Yeah. And there's a word that you probably use in your books at some point.
Most likely, yes.
Yeah. I haven't asked that. Actually, are they spicy? I guess they have to deliver a bit of that, don't they, these books?
Yeah, I would say they're mid-level.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Jane,
they're probably pretty high compared to a military aviation thriller, but they are mid compared to other romance.
My sex scenes go on for 3 chapters. Unbelievable.
Well, I can imagine.
3 sentences if you're lucky. Funny enough, I can see Jane Diamond, sponsored ad pops up on your page there. And Jane is someone else we've had on the podcast as well. So we've done quite well representing the billionaire romance subgenre. It's obviously a very popular one. It's a classic fantasy, I guess, isn't it?
It's an evergreen, yeah.
And I really like the fact that the heroine is always quite often is an equal, or should be an equal, really. They're smart, they're reluctant, they know it's a cliche, and they sort of can't help themselves getting into it. And that's quite a good thing as well. It's not like the old 1950s heroine who's a passive reactor to this male.
No, definitely not. And that's definitely a part of my brand, something I've seen over and over in reviews. I've had some readers email me about that. So I've taken that and I really run with it. And so my heroines tend to be ambitious, and they have agency. And, in one book, the billionaire even gives up his position as a CEO to make sure there's no HR violation.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah. So she gets to keep her job, not him.
Yeah.
No.
Good, how it should be. Audiobooks?
Exactly. Sorry?
Audiobooks. Have you had the audio stuff?
Yes. Yes, so I have sold rights for 4 books to WF House, actually,
Yes.
to Craig, and yep. I spoke to him a while ago. And then I've self-produced 4 others. I mean, not self-produced. I paid for them, but yes. I have not narrated them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really it. So I have 8 out. I will say that audiobooks is a completely different realm. So I haven't seen the monetary gain from that
okay.
To be comparable at all to ebooks, right? But right. there's also a long startup to that, right? There's a
yeah.
high initial cost. It is a different readership. There's some overlap, but not entirely. And so I'm going to continue investing in that, but I don't know when it will start paying off, really.
Yeah.
But speaking of branding as well, at a certain point, you know, if I want to be in the top 100 with some of the other authors up there, you need to have audio for new releases. That's just the thing that authors do, you know, at that level. And so if I want to continue trying to reach that, then I do need to keep investing in audio as well.
Do you have your audio book ready to go at time of release, at new release?
I never have before. No. But now I'm you know, considering if that's something I need to have in the future.
Yeah, there's such a lead time for audiobooks, isn't there? The production and so on. Getting yourself in their diary is a
hassle. And then obviously you have to have the book ready months before.
Yeah.
And then just sit on it, I guess, while they record.
Yeah. 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 Tricky.
It's tough.
Okay. Well, look, it's been brilliant talking to you. I'm very impressed with everything you've done. The books look amazing. I fully expect at some point you can give yourself permission to do a slightly different subgenre. And I think you'll take some readers with you, I'm sure. Because there's got
I hope so.
At
yeah.
some point you're going to run out of billionaires, right? There's only so many billionaires in the world.
We joke about that. I mean, another billionaire author. I think there are only like a couple of thousand billionaires yeah. in the world.
There actually aren't that many, yeah.
No, like 400 in the States or something. So yeah. It's realistically, how many of them are between the ages of 30 and 40 and single?
And incredibly attractive.
Exactly.
So chiseled looks. I mean, in reality, they look like Elon Musk. He's a lovely guy. But you wouldn't necessarily...
Exactly. But maybe not a hero, no.
Maybe not. Well, he's sort of Tony Stark-like hero, but not...
True. Romance lead.
Not quite as good looking as Robert Downey Jr. That's a very mean thing to say about poor old Elon. Okay, look, thank you very much indeed. It's been
I don't think poor is the right word.
No, that's right. We'll cry on his banknotes.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you so much indeed, Olivia. Real pleasure having you on. And yeah, look forward to seeing your future continued success.
Thank you. Likewise.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. I think that really is an object lesson in choosing a lane and staying in it, because everything that we talk about with marketing, which is tricky and hard, becomes easier when everything you do is so easily identifiable with one particular audience. And you can kind of tell during the interview, Olivia's perhaps slightly reluctant that she's there and would like to write some other stuff, but is worried about doing that, quite rightly, because she understands her audience are her audience, and you move away from that sort of at your peril.
Yeah, you do, and you can obviously do it if you want to, and the consequence that is that you might not sell as many books. So if you found a successful area that you've got readers who are enjoying your books and more readers are coming along, then it does make sense, commercially at least, to stay and write more of the things that are working. So yeah, it's a tricky one. I've had a few ideas that I'd like to explore buzzing around for years, really, but they're very different from what I write now. And I know that if I did that, then, you know, it's not likely to be as successful, and it would cost me money, because I'm not the time I'm spending writing something else is the time I'm not spending writing something for my audience. But, you know, there will come a time when I decide that I'm prepared to take a little bit of a hit just to do something that I want to do. So, you know, I want to write a book set on Mars, James. That's the
Is that you've never mentioned that before?
No, I've got. So I love all that. I love kind of curiosity and the ingenuity and all that kind of stuff. And I think it'd be very interesting to, you know, something like The Martian, which I think is really fun.
Yeah,
a fun book. But I've got some ideas about.
Of course, originally self-published.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, one day maybe, but it's a big diversion from what I do. So. I pick my moment. I did a book. I've been wanting to write about Chernobyl for years, and I did Wormwood this year. Which is not a million miles from the books I write. It has an espionage element to it, but it's not Milton. It's not, you know, it's set in, it's historical, so it's a little way from what I normally do, and it won't sell as well as a Milton book. But you know, that's fine. I decided to do it anyway. So it's done okay, but I got to write something that I really wanted to write. So maybe one book a year will be kind of slightly more for me, and then the rest of the books will be for my readers.
I'd like to write a book set on Mars.
Oh, okay.
I'm also fascinated. In fact, I was reading this week about Curiosity has been generating oxygen. I don't know if you saw that. From the soil. Right. It's actually generated quite a lot, which is a very good sign for potential colonization in the future.
Yeah.
But it also made me think, I don't know if you've read Kid Stanley Robinson's magnificent trilogy on Mars called Red Mars, Green Mars and Blue Mars.
No,
basically about the terraforming of the planet. Absolutely fantastic. I adored it. I read it in my 20s. But there was an anti-group. They were called the Reds, as opposed to the Greens you get on Earth, who were against terraforming of the first settlers.
Yeah.
Of course, they didn't want to change and corrupt the landscape. And I thought, well, that ship's already sailed. If Curiosity is actually generating oxygen and carrying out these experiments, of course, however clean they make these objects when they arrive on Mars, they probably have something on them. But we can co-author it then. I look forward to that. We'll do a chapter each. Like, we'll be the Suzanne and Caroline of interstellar, interplanetary
travel. Interstellar smut.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll do the smut.
Oh, dear.
No, I'm good at that.
Good grief. I can just... I'd rather cut into that famous Partridge scene. Dirty protest, but we won't go there.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this Mars book. I'll start sketching it out and start sending you over some ideas. So we're away now.
Oh my God.
Blatch and Dawson. Good. Okay, look, thank you very much indeed. Thank you to our guest, Olivia Hales. Olivia Hale, I should say, a brilliant, very impressive author. And thank you to the team behind the scenes who make this podcast an actual thing that you can listen to and watch. Don't forget to go to patreon.com if you want a chance to be our next book lab victim and have your cover, blurb, and writing analyzed by experts in those three fields. You need to go to patreon.com/self-publishing show and sign up at the gold level in the next 2 weeks. And we might see you in Nink. Who knows? If you come and say hello, use the magic word, would you like a beer, the magic phrase, and you'll get a conversation. We might even be back to hugging. I don't know. Are we back to hugging? Are we still handshaking? Are we fist bumping?
I think it's a stoic handshake from me. A
stoic handshake. As long as you look in their eyes, that's what you should do. Right, that's it. I can see. I think Scout's getting restless. We need to buzz off. Thank you very much indeed. All that remains for me to say is a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.